Sometime at 4 o'clock in the morning on December the 4th, 1969, Chicago police stormed the office of the Illinois Black Panther Party with guns blazing. They fired first, they fired 100 times. They murdered two Panthers, Fred Hampton and Mark Clark. Although they initially claimed self-defense, their lies were quickly exposed, and the people were left asking, were Fred Hampton and Mark Clark executed by the state?
This is the Still Spying Podcast, presented by Defending Rights in Dissent, and I'm its host, Chip Gibbons. Still Spying is a limited podcast series exploring the history of FBI political surveillance. Later in this episode, I'll be joined by Jeffrey Boss, who knew Fred Hampton.
The FBI had long targeted black descent, but in 1967, it started a COINTELPRO, that is a secret program of covert actions designed to neutralize, disrupt, and otherwise get rid of political groups it did not like, on so-called black nationalist hate groups. The initial targets were the Revolutionary Action Movement, the Student Nonviolent Committee, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, and the Nation of Islam. The Panthers were not one of the groups originally targeted, but they were added to the program in 1968, and by 1969, they were the primary target, unleashing a uniquely ferocious and violent response from the nation's premier law enforcement and domestic intelligence agency. According to the Church Committee, the landmark Senate investigation into the U.S. intelligence community, of the total 295 authorized covert actions under COINTELPRO against black nationalist hate groups, 233 of them were directed against the Black Panthers. The Church Committee found these actions were designed to promote violence between the Black Panther Party and other well-armed, potentially violent organizations, to disrupt the Black Panther Party by promoting internal dissension, to undermine support of the Black Panther Party and to destroy the party's public image, including promoting criticism of the Black Panther Party in mass media and preventing them and their supporters from expressing their views in public, and to use cooperation between the Federal Bureau of Investigation and local police departments in disrupting the Black Panther Party, the strategy that was used to assassinate Fred Hampton. Quoting from the Church Committee, this is what they found. Although the claimed purpose of the Bureau's COINTELPRO tactics was to present violence, some of the FBI's tactics against the Black Panther Party were clearly intended to foster violence, and many others could reasonably have been expected to cause violence. For example, the FBI's efforts to intensify the degree of animosity between the Black Panther Party and the Blackstone Rangers, a Chicago street gang, included sending an anonymous letter to the gang's leader falsely informing him that the Chicago Panthers had a hit on him. The stated intent of the letter was to induce the Rangers' leader to take reprisals against the Panther leadership. Similarly, in Southern California, the FBI launched a covert effort to create further dissension in the ranks of the Black Panther Party. This effort included mailing anonymous letters and caricatures to Black Panther Party members ridiculing the local and national Black Panther Party leadership for the express purpose of exacerbating an existing gang war between the Black Panther Party and an organization called the United Slaves. This gang war, and I note there are internal quotes within the Church Committee report around gang war, resulted in the killing of four Black Panther members by the United Slaves and in numerous beatings and shootings. Although individual incidents in the dispute cannot be directly traced to the FBI, FBI officials were clearly aware of the violent nature of the dispute, engaged in actions which they hoped would prolong and intensify the dispute, and proudly claimed credit for violent clashes between the rival factions. In the words of one FBI official, their actions resulted in shootings, beatings, and a high degree of unrest in the area of Southeast San Diego. Those are the findings of a U.S. Senate investigation. So who were the Black Panthers, this group that provoked such a violent response from J. Edgar Hoover and his men? The Black Panthers were formed in 1966 by Bobby Seale and Huey Newton. They were initially inspired by the likes of Malcolm X and Robert Williams, who had supported black arms defense against the Ku Klux Klan. They worked to defend the black community against police brutality. They started a cop watch program, but with guns, which they carried legally and openly, along with a copy of the California Penal Code. With the guns and the law, they would follow Oakland police officers to make sure they are behaving themselves and following the laws. You know, if the police have nothing to hide, they have nothing to fear, right? Well, needless to say, California gun laws were changed. They also started survival programs meant to ensure the survival pending revolution of the black community. The most famous of this was the Panther Free Breakfast Program. The Panthers organized around a 10-point program, which was organized into two sections, what we want now, what we believe, each having 10 points. In the What We Want Now section, the Panthers announced, "We want freedom. We want power to determine the destiny of our black community. We want full employment for our people. We want an end to the robbery by the capitalist of our black and oppressed communities. We want decent housing fit for the shelter of human beings. We want education for our people that exposes the true nature of this decadent American society. We want education that teaches us our true history and our role in the present day society. We want black men exempt from military service. We want an immediate end to police brutality and the murder of black people. We want freedom for all black men held in federal, state, county, city prisons and jails. We want all black people, when brought to trial, to be tried in a court by a jury of their peer group or people from their black communities as defined in the United States Constitution. We want land, bread, housing, education, clothing, justice, and peace." The Black Panther Party was openly socialist, something that angered J. Edgar Hoover. He cited this fact when he called them the greatest threat to the internal security of the country. They were also internationalists who saw themselves as part of a global struggle against U.S. imperialism taking place within the wider context of national liberation movements against colonialism in the global South. In this respect, they were deeply influenced by the work of Frantz Fanon and his seminal book, The Wretched of the Earth. While they were no doubt a black liberation movement aiming at freedom for black Americans oppressed by white supremacy and capitalism in the United States, they also sought to build coalitions with other groups. Fred Hampton of the Illinois Party, along with Bob Lee, were creators of the original Rainbow Coalition. This included not just the Panthers, but the Young Lords, a Puerto Rican group, and the Young Patriots, a white organization based mainly of Appalachian migrants in Chicago. A video exists of Black Panther Bobby Lee speaking to the Young Patriots. He spoke with people with thick Appalachian accents, arguing that they had a lot of things in common. They both hated police brutality, and they both were being exploited by their landlords, and that this was the beginning of a common program of poor, oppressed, and working class people. This is the group that the FBI sought to wipe out. In the next segment, I'll be joined by Jeffrey Bass. He knew Fred Hampton in life, and he was the attorney who represented the survivors of the raid that killed him. It's a powerful, moving segment. For the next segment, we're going to talk about one of the darkest chapters in the FBI's history. This is what Noam Chomsky called the gravest domestic crime of the Nixon administration. That is the murder of Fred Hampton and Mark Clark, two Black Panthers, during a Chicago police raid orchestrated by the Federal Bureau of Investigation. I'm joined by Jeffrey Haas. Jeffrey is the author of The Assassination of Fred Hampton, How the FBI and Chicago Police Murdered a Black Panther. He is an attorney and the co-founder of the People's Law Office, whose clients included the Black Panthers, Students for a Democratic Society, community activists, and a large number of those opposed to the Vietnam War. He has handled cases involving prisoners' rights, Puerto Rican nationalists, protesters opposed to human rights violations in Central America, police torture, and the wrongfully accused. He was also one of the lead attorneys in the suit Hampton v. Hanoran, which was filed against the Chicago police, the prosecutor, and later the FBI. He interviewed the survivors of the raid that killed Hampton the night it happened. Thank you for joining me today.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
So Fred Hampton is still really widely revered in a lot of circles on the left, but unfortunately, this isn't history that's frequently taught. And a lot of the mainstream narrative about the Black Panthers over the years have been very misleading, if not outright false. Could you start by explaining to us who was Fred Hampton?
Fred Hampton grew up in Maywood, Chicago. He was an unusual kid in the sense that even when he was 10 years old, he organized the local kids and brought them over to his family's house for breakfast. So he started his own free breakfast program at the age of 10. The young Fred early on was hesitant to accept injustice anywhere. He went to Proviso East High School. At that time, there were it was increasingly Black. Maybe it had been almost all white. One of the first things Fred did is he led a walk of the school because they wanted to be homecoming queens. That was just something that some people said, well, that's not so significant. But for Fred, it was just an issue. And then soon he was also protesting the fact there were very few Black teachers and Black administrators there. So early on, Fred was pushing for rights for Black people, but he also had a great ability to bring people together. Racial tensions at the school, even after he graduated, the principal would call Fred back to talk to both sides. So he was both a unifier and an organizer.
What were his political views? What was he doing with the Black Panther Party?
Well, Fred, of course, like all of many of us, were product. It was a product of the 60s. He marched with Dr. King when he went to Chicago. A Black woman next to him was spit on by a white woman. And Fred said, well, I'm not going to respond nonviolently if the people against us are violent. I think from that place on, while he had a great deal of respect for Dr. King, he also started reading Malcolm X and some of the Panther leaders, Huey Newton. He was really well read and saw what was going on in the context of both Black history, but revolutions that were happening all over the world that were led by socialist ideals.
And what was the relationship between the Black Panther Party and the law enforcement authorities? How did the FBI view the Black Panther Party?
Well, I think J. Edgar Hoover saw any Black group that might have power as a threat. He said he put out a memo specific nationalist groups, and somebody asked him what that was, and he said any Black group with a national headquarters. So it wasn't limited to a Black nationalist ideology. In fact, the NAACP and the Urban League and SNCC, in fact, were all targets. Elijah Muhammad in the Muslim movement was a target. And he really didn't like any form of Black organizing and saw all of it as a threat. But however, I think he reserved his strongest fear and desire to destroy towards not only the Black movement, but the Black Panther Party. And so we discovered in conjunction with the church committee and our own discovery in the Hampton case that he was putting out memos to neutralize the Black Panther Party by any means necessary. And it was he sent out directives to FBI, the special agents in charge in all cities that had a Black Panther Party. And he talked about disrupt, destroy, and neutralize the Panthers by any means necessary, and to encourage them to come up with constructive ideas about how to separate the Panthers from other Black groups, to defame them to white groups, and in the case of Chicago, actually put out some a death threat on Fred. The head of the special agent in charge in Chicago actually authored a letter to Jeff Fort, the leader of the Blackstone Rangers, the most powerful and well-armed gang in Chicago, and he wrote a note, of course, not on FBI stationery, saying to the Panthers, saying, I'm just a Black guy. I'm hanging out with the Panthers. They got a hit out on you. I know what I'd do if I were you, a Black brother. So basically, they were telling the Panthers that Ford and the Rangers were going to kill him and inviting them to respond. In this case, I think Ford didn't trust that this really was a Black brother, and he didn't take any action. But the intent to use the gang against Fred was clearly there.
So let's talk about the raid itself. What happened on December the 4th, 1969?
Well, we had started, a group of us, my much at the request of Fred Hampton, started the People's Law Office in 1969 in the summer. The Panthers, the Young Lords, the Young Patriots, the anti-war movement, SDS, they were all being harassed by the police and charged with everything from selling newspapers on the street, disorderly demonstrations. So they came to us, and particularly Fred said, we need a People's Law Office. We need somebody to represent us. Myself and some of the others worked for Legal Aid. We couldn't do criminal defense. We couldn't appear for movement people. So that summer, we started something called the People's Law Office on Halstead Street in something that still had the awning that said Fless's Homemade Sausage. And that was the beginning of the People's Law Office. That was in August of 69. And we represented the Panthers much after that. The Panthers were trying to buy their building because the landlord wanted to evict them because the police had come in and raided it twice and the FBI once set it on fire. And I'd actually seen Fred on December 2nd filling out the final form so he could purchase the building. Less than 36 hours later, my law partner knocked on my back door on the morning of December 4th, about 6 in the morning, and said, they've murdered the chairman. Mm-hmm. And I said, what? And he said, there was a police raid this morning and they murdered the chairman, Fred Hampton. And I couldn't believe it because Fred was so full of life. I'd seen him speak. I'd seen him bring a crowd to their feet. I'd seen him energize people and excite people and make us feel that we were invincible. And so to be told that he was dead. So Skip went to the apartment to look at the evidence. The police had not sealed it. I went to the police station and interviewed the three survivors who had not been shot. Fred had been killed, Mark Clark was killed, and four other Panthers had bullet wounds and were at Cook County Hospital. I interviewed Deborah Johnson that morning. Deborah was Fred's fiance, 8 months pregnant with their son, when the police came in. And Deborah came into the interview room. She was still in her nightgown, obviously pregnant. And so I asked Deborah what happened. And she looked at me and said, I was in the bed with Fred. And I said, and what happened? And she said, they were shooting. I got on top of him to try to protect him from the bullets. After there was a lull in the firing and they pulled me out of the room. Fred never really woke up. He just raised his head and put it back down. After they pulled me out, I saw two police officers, or two pigs, as she said it, go in the room. I heard one of them say, is he dead yet? I heard two shots, and the other one said, he's good and dead now. And that's how she described to me what happened. Two other Panthers I also interviewed, they talked about how following a knock on the door with no announcement, the police broke in and they started firing from the front and the back. And that's what they told me that morning. At the same time that was happening, the prosecutor, Ed Hanrahan, was going on TV and telling the story that the police officers were serving a search warrant. And they were surprised when after announcing themselves, the Panthers opened fire on them and kept shooting. And they claimed they even had three ceasefires. So that was the police story. My law partner and other people went to the apartment, including Bobby Rush. My partner had the presence of mind to bring a filmmaker, Mike Gray, and a minister with him so that when they walked into the apartment, they actually saw the condition that it was left in by the police about 3 hours earlier. And some of this was captured in Mike Gray's film, The Murder of Fred Hampton, because Mike Gray was the one doing the shooting at that time. And they walked in and they saw the bloody mattress where Fred had been murdered, a spot on the ground where they had actually dragged Fred's body out, almost like a trophy, so that all the raiders could see it. So for quite a while, we had a dispute publicly. They charged the survivors with attempted murder, and they put out their story. The Tribune carried their story and the headlines. One of their stories was that Fred Hampton had fired at the police who were coming in the back door. And Hanrahan gave the Tribune a picture of a black dot, two black dots next to the back door, and said, these are the bullet holes from Fred Hampton's shot. We brought alternative press out there at the other media, and they said, this is what they call gunshots. And actually, they were nailheads. At that point, the Raiders' story began to come undone, and eventually the charges against the Panthers were dropped. They were based on a phony lab report by the Chicago Police Department that there were two shotgun shells that they claimed came from a Panther weapon. In fact, those shells came from a police shotgun. So we also brought in an expert, and when we examined all the bullet holes and put dowels in them to show the trajectories, it showed us that over 90 shots came from the direction of the police. Only one shot went out. That was from the weapon at Mark Clark, who was in the living room, and that went up into the ceiling. And we believe it was a reactionary shot after he had already got a fatal shot in the heart, because it went up into the ceiling of the door, through the door into the ceiling of the hallway.
We know that the police frequently don't tell the truth. I don't have to tell you that. And that we're in sort of an age now where video has been debunking a lot of sort of false police claims about their own actions. But in this case, the police failed to seal the crime scene, and the Panther Party invited the community in to view what had happened. What do you think the impact of that was?
It was tremendous, because the Black community lined up, the Black community being somewhat divided on the Panthers, but they didn't accept that a Black leader could be killed in his bed in a police raid at 4 a.m. So the Black community immediately protested, even including at that time Mayor Daley, some of his sort of toms on the city council and everything. The Black people showed a lot of independence, objected to it. The news media also covered the bullet holes. Even Mike Royko wrote a report that the Panthers, if they were shooting, they must have been shooting at themselves, because all the bullets came towards them. I mean, and so pretty quickly, a coalition formed of the Black community and liberal whites who were demanding an investigation. So what we knew was Hanrahan also was the heir apparent to Daley, and he was running on a law and order platform and calling the Panthers a gang and calling the gang members nothing but animals. So in many ways, he expected this raid that he would get credit for the murder of Fred Hampton and Mark Clark, that would escalate his political career. In fact, he killed his career. He never got elected to anything after that. He was defeated running for state's attorney again, for Congress, and even for mayor. But as the tide began to turn, we filed a civil rights suit against the police raiders who were assigned to Hanrahan, the crime lab that had come up with this phony thing. And they also had done a totally phony internal investigation in which they had absolved all of the police officers. And so we ran into a tough 80-year-old judge who grew up in Alabama, who hated the Panthers and hated us as their lawyers. When the raid happened, I was 27, and my partner, law partner Clint Taylor, was 23. We filed a federal suit, and we had done work in court defending the movement, but we'd never really been in federal court, a civil case, and actually got thrown out of court originally by the judge, who said that our accusations of murder were scandalous, and we had to get the case reinstated. I think things really changed in 1972, 2 years after we filed a suit. The court reinstated it, but it turned out there was a newspaper story that a man named William O'Neill was involved with a Chicago police officer in shaking down and killing drug dealers in Indiana. And they arrested both of them. And O'Neill's defense was, I'm an FBI informant. I've been working with the FBI since 1968. We knew O'Neill. He had been at one point even in charge of security. And so we wondered, what's the connection here between O'Neill, an informant, and this raid? At the same time, the church, there was a raid on an FBI office in Pennsylvania, and they discovered some documents which led to the discovery of the COINTELPRO program.
And it was by activists, right? This was by the Citizens Commission to investigate the FBI.
And so they were raiding the draft board, I think, to prevent people from being drafted to the Vietnam War, but they brought these documents out, and it showed this heading COINTELPRO, which people quickly figured out was a clandestine FBI program aimed at spying on and actually targeting the movement and the Black movement. So we said, is there a connection here between this FBI informant and this formal FBI program targeting the Panthers? And one of the FBI documents specifically said, prevent the rise of a black messiah who could unify and electrify the black masses. And they said that Elijah Muhammad might have been that. King could be that if he gave up his supposed dedication to nonviolence. Elijah Muhammad. And so, I think they mentioned Stokely Carmichael. So Fred Hampton fit description. And so we say they have a program to prevent the rise of a black messiah who could unify people. They have an FBI informant close to Fred Hampton who was in the apartment that night, even though he left. Is this COINTELPRO program have anything to do with the raid? And for the FBI denied it. There was an FBI grand jury. They never mentioned COINTELPRO. The raiders said, oh, no, we had our own informant. That's what led to the search warrant. It was the Watergate era, and one of the local prosecutors didn't want to be accused of hiding documents. So we asked for all these documents in discovery, and after denying it, he produced a document was in the FBI do not file file, which meant copies were not sent anywhere else. That file was showed a floor plan of the apartment where Hampton and Deborah Johnson were staying and at the time of the raid. And it didn't just show where the address, it showed a layout of all the rooms, and including even the bed where Hampton and Johnson sleep. So when we questioned O'Neill, he said, yes, me and my FBI contact put that floor plan together and we gave it to the police. And even though the police denied that, he said they had that. They did admit that they met with Mitchell. They had that floor plan. And we looked at the trajectory of the bullets and they very much went toward the bed where Fred Hampton was sleeping. So they put together that this whole raid was started by the FBI. They didn't want to take direct public credit for it. So they gave it to a politically ambitious prosecutor who would be quite willing to carry out their dirty work. And then as we got more and more discovery, we also found that they actually gave O'Neill a bonus after the raid, claiming the information that he gave was invaluable and not available from any other source.
Do you think this went?
By the time we really got learned about COINTELPRO and everything, Hoover had passed away. And so we went past Roy Mitchell. We went to Roy Mitchell, O'Neill's control, and his head of the Racial Matters Squad. And then we went to the head of the special agent in charge in Chicago. We had some difficulty going above that. In reality, this was the Nixon White House. I think John Mitchell, Attorney General, was certainly aware of COINTELPRO. Whether or not he was aware of this raid, we don't know. We also were trying to depose Mayor Daley at that time to find out, and he also passed away. So we didn't get to depose him.
So there are allegations that Fred Hampton was drugged that night. Could you talk about those?
Yeah. When Deborah said to me there was gunshots, so it was tremendously loud in that tiny apartment, and she's trying to wake Fred up, and so were the other two guys I interviewed. And Fred was like lying there like half conscious. And so at one point he like raises his head up and then puts it down like he's been drugged or something. And with all this noise, nobody could have just slept through it. So that was very suspicious. And then when we had our own autopsy following the original one, they found a large amount of secobarbital, a drug, in his system. Fred didn't take drugs. He didn't drink alcohol. So the question was, who drugged him? And was it, that explains why he couldn't wake up that morning. We don't know who did that, but there is that evidence, that very strong evidence that he was drugged, and his behavior that day and not waking up is consistent with that.
So as the title of your book suggests, you view the murder of Fred Hampton as an assassination.
Absolutely. And I think that's one of the reasons Chomsky felt it was the most important domestic crime of the Nixon era, because it was premeditated. It was not just police brutality. It was a planned assassination. The police came in that morning at 4 a.m. in plain clothes. They came in a gas truck they came in armed with their own handguns, shotguns, a .30 carbine, and a .45 caliber machine gun, all of which they used. When in fact, the machine gun was shot through the walls of the apartment in an attempt to all through three walls towards the bed of Fred Hampton. So they obviously went in there well-armed. Some, if not all the Raiders, probably knew that the target was Fred Hampton. Perhaps some didn't, but we think the leader did. And this one police officer, Carmody, he fired his pistol twice. He was the only one with a pistol who came in from the rear. He filled out a firearms report saying he shot somebody and it said distance and he put question mark. From what we see and what the ballistics showed, Fred was shot twice at short range, basically in the temple and in the head. He wasn't just shot by a random shot that came through a wall.
So what do you think are the lessons of this for today's activist, or just in general people today? Maybe not just...
You know, I think we obviously shouldn't underestimate the role of the government in terms of spying. Obviously, methods have gotten much more sophisticated than they were 50 years ago. And we see the government using, when there are protests and so forth, these weaponry and also drones and also obviously spying on people in various ways. So we shouldn't underestimate that, nor their fear of a real black movement arising. I also think that having so much power in a sort of a hierarchical situation is a risk to the movement. And I think the way Black Lives Matter is organizing now, with less hierarchy, different leadership in different cities, I think makes them in many ways less vulnerable to the kind of attack that was done in Chicago. So I think and it's a difficult thing, but O'Neill was not only a spy, but he was a provocateur. He was always urging the Panthers to do kind of crazy things. He even had an electric chair set up to supposedly scare potential informants from joining the party, although he was one. And Fred said, put that shit away, because it didn't make any sense to him. So I think that's another thing, is somebody who doesn't quite fit. He had a car. He always seemed to have money. He wasn't much interested in the ideology, but he could help fix the Panther office after raids. You know, the use of informants, and, you know, I don't want to make people suspicious of everybody else, but that's another lesson that we could learn. I also think the Panthers had a very heavy anti-police rhetoric, including off the pig. And I think to them it meant get police out of the community that are attacking black people or not respecting them. But the police may well have seen that as a threat, and maybe they underestimated what the response would be to that.
I want to thank you for joining me. I was just joined by Jeffrey Haas. He's the author of The Assassination of Fred Hampton, How the FBI and the Chicago Police Murdered a Black Panther. He is a longtime lawyer for people's movements, including having co-founded the People's Law Office and having been involved in the federal lawsuit in response to the assassination of Fred Hampton.